I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Thousands of acres of farmland are underwater, and at least four lives have been lost because of severe flooding on the Missouri River. Today, we hear stories from along the river's path. We'll learn about the state of the levee system before, during, and after the flood, and we'll talk to farmers about how all this water is affecting their operations. We'll also check in on Buchanan County, Missouri, where at least one levee was breached. Then we'll uncover the little-known history of race and the last military executions at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Our guest says conditions there in the 1950s were a precursor of things to come in criminal justice at large. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Water problems here in Kansas City aside, the real flooding story has been unfolding upstream. At least four people have died and an as yet unknown number of livestock. Thousands of acres of farmland are underwater. Long stretches of interstate highways, not to mention some key local commuting routes, are closed. Billions of dollars in property losses and a state of emergency declared by Missouri's governor. Even as the floodwaters that crested late last week now begin to recede, there are predictions that more flooding may be headed our way in a couple of weeks. It's flooding season in the Midwest again, and this year's massive problems are raising some familiar questions about how we control the once unruly Missouri River and, practically speaking, what can be done. In a bit, we'll be joined by a representative of the Army Corps of Engineers, which is largely responsible for the levee system that seeks to prevent exactly what is happening now, as well as emergency responders from north of Kansas City. But first, we want to get a sense of what it's like for those who have experienced some of the losses I've mentioned. Pat Sheldon is president of the Benton, Washington Levee District in Iowa. He's a farmer. Pat joins us from Sydney, Iowa. Welcome.
Good morning.
And also Blake Hurst. He is also a farmer and president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Welcome to you, Blake.
Good morning.
I'm also joined here in studio by KCUR's Peggy Lowe, who's been reporting on a number of problems related to the flooding this week. Peggy, thanks.
Good morning, Brian.
So let's start with you, Pat. Help our listeners understand where you are up there in Iowa and what you're seeing there.
I'm in Sydney, Iowa right now, the county seat up on top of the Lus Hills. I live about 10 miles straight west of there, which is a little town of Percival, Iowa, by Nebraska City. We're about 15 miles north of the Iowa-Missouri line.
Okay, so not too far from Missouri territory. And what are you seeing when you look outside over the river?
Water everywhere, places we've never seen water in my lifetime.
And is that, you're the president of the levee district. Help us understand what that means. Your levee district is responsible for protecting how much of that land?
We have one of the largest levee districts in the area, maybe in the United States, that's a Corps-sponsored levee. We have 42 miles of levee protecting people, thousands and thousands of acres.
And what happened?
We had more water than we could hold. We had overtopping on lots of places. We've got at least six full breaches on our section of levee to be repaired. From our latest update from the Omaha District this morning, in the Omaha District, there are 54 full or partial breaches in their system.
I know that you have some responsibilities in terms of the levee district, but you also have your own land. How have you personally been affected?
We had about 2,200 of 2,500 acres that we farm underwater. So,
wow, and I guess needless to say, that's going to have a pretty drastic impact on your livelihood.
Oh yeah, and everyone's. We've still had crop in the bins, which is perfectly normal this time of year. So that's last year's income, and we're looking at possibly not being able to plant this year. So everybody's trying to figure out how we're going to go 2 years without any income. So.
I want to come back to you, Pat, but Blake Hurst is joining us by Skype, and where are you right now, Blake?
Well, I'm actually in Jefferson City, but I live about 6 miles east of the Missouri River bottom in Atchison County, so just a few miles south of Pat.
You of course, do spend time in Jefferson City. A lot of the work you do with Missouri Farm Bureau is lobbying and advocating, but I imagine this week has felt a little more personal, very different.
Yeah, I guess what I'd like to start out by saying I hope that you're not giving the impression that this thing is over. When a levee breaches and fills up the bottom, it doesn't drain out nearly as quickly as it came in. And as Pat can attest, it will be weeks and maybe months before this land is clear again. Not only that, but a lot of the snowpack in the upper reaches of Missouri hasn't even entered the river yet. We're just starting on a flooding season that's going to be historic by any measure. And if I was in Kansas City, I'd be paying a lot of attention to this situation over the next few weeks.
Yeah, not to mention that even when the water is gone, that doesn't mean the what's left behind is immediately usable again. So what? How about your own farm, Blake? You are a farmer there.
We're along a tributary of the Missouri called the Turkio River. Had some minor flooding early on in this event. Some levees broke down further on that river, which although they flooded the town of Craig, Missouri, actually took some pressure off of our farm. So as often happens in these floods, one person's misfortune is another's advantage.
What is the impact on farmers and ranchers? You're the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. You must be in touch with quite a few of your colleagues.
Well, Pat is exactly right. I mean, we did not have any warning in 2011, our last major flooding. Farmers had several weeks to prepare. This time we had maybe 48 hours. The grain was not moved out of the bottom. A combination of the time of year, as Pat mentioned, and then some weaker prices because of the trade disputes. Farmers were not selling grain as quickly as usual. That grain is all run. The bins are exploding, kind of a slow motion explosion, but that's exactly what they're doing. As the grain swells up, the bins collapse. So all kinds of farmers up and down the river are looking at a 2-year loss of income. But it also affects everybody that's traveling north, that are really driving on 100-mile long detours. Much of our fertilizer for our spring planting and our farming comes from right across the river in Nebraska. We can no longer get it. There's no way to get from our farm to Nebraska, or at least not without an hour and a half long detour.
That's because of the closure of Interstate
Yeah, that's
29.
29, 136, east-west roads are all closed that go across the bottom. We are going to have a very long spring trying to get supplies moved in. One of the grain elevators underwater is where we deliver most of our grain. We will get paid for the grain we delivered earlier this winter, but we're still waiting on those checks because obviously there's nobody in the office to do the paperwork.
Pat Sheldon, the Benton, Washington levee district you mentioned is one of the largest. What does rebuilding look like? I mean, that may feel like that's a long way off even, but you mentioned numerous breaches, numerous overtoppings. Is this a how difficult a project are we looking at?
Oh, it's going to be well over a year long. They will come in and put some material across the breaches to give us maybe a 25-year flood level protection. But there's our system looks. I've flown it, not for a week or so, but it looks like it could be almost a total rebuild. So you're looking at in the $500 million area just for our levee district.
Let me ask the two of you to stick around for just a moment here, and let me ask my colleague Peggy Lowe, who's been reporting on the flooding and on these levee breaches, how closely do Pat and Blake's experiences match what you have been reporting on and hearing from others?
I'll just be echoing what both they said. I really like what Blake said about this is not over, and it's not going to be over for another 4 or 5 months, if that. Not only is that entire area under, gosh, 8, 10, you never know how many feet of water. But as he said, a lot of that stored grain is exploding in the bins. I was up above in a plane on Friday night, and you can literally see the tops of the grain bins have popped off, and the yellow corn is spilling into the water. It's an absolute mess out there. And as well as that, it's not going to be just about the snowpack. The Corps of Engineers is still releasing water from Yankton at Gavin's Point Dam. And so, for instance, So a lot of the guys I was talking to over the weekend were really nervous, especially even down here in Kansas City. So this isn't over by any stretch of the imagination.
And Peggy, you reported on the enormous number of levees that have seen breaches all up and down the river. Obviously, that's not how this is supposed to work. was the storm that hit and the rain that has been experienced so unusual that there was simply nothing that could be done, or are there questions about the management of the system?
I think that what I've learned in the last week or so covering the floods is that, you know, management of the Missouri River, of course, is a complicated issue. And I talked to a geohydrologist, for instance, who said he really blames the Corps on a lot of these problems because they have narrowed the river so much. And they have made it into this stream instead of what it used to be. He said, this isn't what Lewis and Clark saw when they first arrived. You know, this is, it used to be a wide semi or multi-channel river, and now it's just this narrow, narrow thing that looks like a piece of spaghetti on a plate, is how he described it. So he doesn't like that. And so he said, when all these levees then are forced with these big weather events, you know, of course they're going to fail because there's this violent water rushing down a narrow tube. So when we looked at the levees, you know, 11 of them failed in this area.
I'm going to have to, Peggy.
Go ahead.
I'm going to have to.
Blake Hurst.
We're going to have to challenge that a little bit. We have had those levees there for many years, and it's only in the past 10 years or so we've seen flooding levels of this often and this magnitude.
So, Blake,
had a failure of levees south of the mountains. We've changed the management of the river.
Exactly.
That's clearly what's happened. And Peggy's hydrologist friend is making the idea that we should solve severe flooding every once in a while, but having a flood every year, that seems like rather silly.
No, that's not what he said at all, Blake. No.
We've got I-29 going up and down this river bottom. We've got railroads going up and down this river bottom. The number of floods we have will eventually force people to move out of the bottom. I mean,
right.
Because they cannot stand to live like they're living now.
So, Blake Hurst, is it your contention that you believe something that this is an avoidable situation, that this could have been avoided?
Clearly not every flood is avoidable, but you have to ask the question of why this is our fourth or fifth one in the last decade when we went four or five decades without a major flood. That's the question that has to be asked. There's been changes in management of the river, changes in the amount of flood storage there is above here at Gavin's Point and the other reservoirs along the river. Clearly, we can't avoid all of these. Mother Nature is always in charge. But this idea that we can return to Lewis and Clark, it's just not going to happen.
And I didn't hear Peggy Lowe saying that. I apologize for any misunderstanding. Pat Sheldon, tell me more. I mean, the Army Corps of Engineers manages the release of water upstream, but of course there is management of the local levees. Exactly how locally, what does your district do? Do local districts like yours have any responsibility that could have done anything differently in a situation like this?
No, we're responsible for the maintenance of it, making sure that it's in good condition. But I would like to add on to what Blake was commenting on. There's been a lot of manipulation to our river channel. They've notched wing dams, the old training structures that keep our channel scoured, all sorts of wildlife projects. And I was also asked to speak at a meeting several years ago where one of their hydrologists was at, and they had it in writing, and I heard it verbally, that all these notching things they've done have slowed the flow of the river 50% to 60% in high water events, which inhibits our ability to get the water through here in high water events. That's one reason that our flooding has become so much more dramatic, and it all stems from the change of the master manual, because we used to be able to get floods through here like this before without the catastrophic events that we're facing now.
Regardless of what comes down the road months or years from now in terms of policy changes or management policy changes, what's next for you in the immediate future, Pat and Blake? What will this next week hold? It's more than just waiting for the waters to recede, I assume. Pat?
Well, I'm making arrangements now. I went through this in 2011 with breaches, so I know the processes we're going to have to go through as far as getting easements from landowners to get onto their property to get the sand that the Corps will use to help with these breaches. So as soon as I get a minute, I intend to start talking to some of those landowners now so that we are prepared to start getting some of ours fixed, and it will expedite our process tremendously, because I've been through it before, unfortunately.
Yeah. And Blake Hurst, what is the Missouri Farm Bureau doing to respond in the immediate aftermath of the flooding that's affecting so many farms?
I want to make one thing perfectly clear. Peggy and I have known each other for a while. She's clearly just reporting on what her source was telling her, and what I'm challenging is this idea, because we'll have this argument again. We do every time we have a flood, that we can somehow return to Eden. It's gone. We can't. We've got to deal with what we have, and what we have is a system that's not working. So what we're going to be doing is talking about how we can make these levees better, how we can perhaps change the amount. What happens, there's a master manual that says we're going to have so many feet of flood control in each of these levees. In other words, as we go into flood, or in each of these reservoirs, as we go into flood season, we have so many feet of free space to gather water in from spring thaw, spring rains. That has been changed. We have less now than we had 30 years ago. We need to reopen that conversation.
All right.
And of course, on this one, we had a terrible dam failure in Nebraska, which caused a lot of the flooding you've seen on the news.
All right, Blake, I need to let you go. We've got a couple
that
other guests standing.
That is an act of God that none of us can anticipate.
Standing by. I appreciate your being with us. Blake Hurst, of the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau, joined us by Skype, and Pat Sheldon, president of the Benton Washington Levee District up in Iowa. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Peggy Lowe from KCUR is still here. Obviously, this is an issue that brings up a lot of passionate response each time there's flooding.
Right. And as Blake said, he and I are old friends. I've been up to his farm. I've done many stories with Blake. We've had him down here for talk shows. I did not suggest, nor did my geologist friend, as he termed it, suggests that we're going back to the way Lewis and Clark found it. That's not it at all. If anything is happening here, everyone I talked to in the last few days criticized the U.S. Corps of Engineers for the way they're managing the river. And that, I think, Blake would completely agree with, because they changed the management from the river from one of flood protection to one of protecting fish and bird wildlife. And that is what many farmers are saying led to these problems. So that's just to clarify.
Well, and so let's dig into that a little bit. We have two other guests with other points of view, including Colonel Douglas Guttormson from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He heads up the Kansas City operation. Colonel Guttormson, thank you so much for being here. Are you with us?
Yeah, good morning, Brian. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you now. We're also joined by Bill Brinton, who is the Emergency Management Coordinator in Buchanan County. That's where St. Joseph is. Welcome to you, Bill.
Good morning.
Let's start, actually, with the situation where you are, Bill. The St. Joseph area saw some pretty serious flooding, didn't it?
Yes, we had a record flooding, reached an all-time high. And in the southwest part of Buchanan County, we have our city of Lathrop and our and Lewis and Clark Village underwater.
Completely underwater. And how did your agencies respond to that? I know there were mandatory evacuations for at least some neighborhoods.
Well, we're very fortunate here. The City of St. Joseph's Emergency Management Director and I, we work very, very closely together. And the city and the county and our neighbors over in Elwood, Kansas, and their guard members, we all worked really hard to keep bad things from happening.
Did some bad things still happen? I mean, is there anything that could have been done to prevent the flooding of some of those communities?
Well, the flooding we had is from a non-federal levee, and that failed in '93 and also failed in 2011. And I work very, very closely with the levee board, and they have taken a lot of time to make sure it's in great condition, but it failed. It's one of those things. It's where the river reached a record high, and it's a non-federal level. It's a non-federal levee, so it's not as high as the others, and it failed. It just happened.
Let me ask you, Colonel Guttormson, with the Army Corps, you probably heard a little bit of our conversation we were just having. A lot of people have questioned some of the Corps' management policies. But let's start with this. Put this in perspective. Compare this flooding we're experiencing this year to 2011, to other years that some of our listeners may remember, 93, maybe others. How does this compare?
Sure. Let me start, Brian, by just saying that, you know, personally, I sympathize with all of those affected by the recent high water. I spent a lot of time on the ground the last week or 10 days making sure that the Kansas City District is adequately supporting state and local efforts. And I've seen some really heroic flood fighting out there. and unfortunately some devastating consequences. But the flood fight that Bill was fighting up in the St. Joe's area, you know, certainly one of those heroic efforts. But to your question, you know, I think every year is a little bit different, and you got to evaluate each year on its merits. In this particular instance, you had a tremendous amount of rain and snow melt, all occurring on frozen or saturated ground. You know, during this bomb cyclone period about 2 weeks ago or so. And, you know, and that resulted in a significant amount of runoff in a very short period of time. And the problem in this particular instance was that most of that runoff was occurring in areas that we did not have, you know, flood control storage dams and reservoirs available to capture it. The flood control storage was upriver of where the water was coming in from. So the water came in really uncontrolled and resulted in the significant flood that we've seen up to this point.
You probably heard Blake Hurst of the Missouri Farm Bureau suggest that the problem here is with the way Army Corps management strategies have changed over the past decade. Obviously, there have been concerns about endangered species and the way water is released upstream. Not putting the blame on climate change or the recent storms. Is that how you see it?
Well, I would say, you know, flood control is always a primary consideration for us. You know, I don't believe that there is a management of the system that would have prevented the flooding that you're seeing out there because, as I indicated, the water did fall in areas that were really uncontrolled flows into the system.
I mean, help me understand how the Army Corps goes about making those decisions. We know, you know, massive amounts of water are being released upstream in South Dakota. It's flowing down here, and a lot of these farmers who are losing billions of dollars in property collectively think that's a problem.
Yeah. So again, I think what you saw here was you saw more water than the Missouri River had the ability to contain. As soon as we got a sense of just how much water was coming into the system, I think up and down the basin, you know, our response was to send teams out onto the ground and help folks like Bill, the non-federal, state and local responders, and the levy sponsors, to assist them with technical and direct assistance in fighting the flood. So that's where we've really been focusing our efforts for the last 7 to 10 days or so is helping the state and local responders control the or fight the floods.
Bill Brinton, as one of those local responders in Buchanan County, what are the next steps that you're looking at? As we heard from our other guests, the floodwaters may be receding, but that doesn't mean the problem is over.
Well, our floodwaters are receding, right? But it's time for us to start thinking about helping people get back into their homes. The levee that failed, like I said, is a non-federal levee, and I just don't really see how it will be replaced, because it takes a little while for all that to happen, and it's going to be open. And as we all know, the spring thaw hasn't even happened yet, and so the possibility exists that this is going to happen again. There's really nothing they can do. And in the Corps' behalf, they've really helped us out a lot, and I'm not sure how you can blame them for the fact that dam broke up in Nebraska or wherever it was, and all that water came rushing down. It's got to go somewhere, right? That's a huge lake, and billions of gallons came down that weren't planned for.
Yeah, I mean, let me bring Peggy Lowe back into the conversation here. Obviously, this is a very complicated system for managing the river. It involves the Army Corps, but not just the Army Corps. It involves these privately managed levees. It involves civically managed, but not under control of federal authorities. Peggy, is this any way to run a river?
Well, I'm certainly no expert, and so I'm just reflecting upon what I have discovered this last weekend. And I'm very thrilled that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Colonel is on here today and talking to us about this. It's just a very complicated system, as it has to be. And we are seeing crazy weather. My hometown is up where that dam burst up in Nebraska. And yeah, I mean, there's not anything you can do with the act of nature that happened.
Colonel Guttormson, you're the Kansas City District Commander. What are the next steps for you and the Army Corps after this immediate crisis has passed? And to be clear, maybe the crisis has not yet passed. But is there periodically a look at those management policies? Is there a look at whether the system is working the way it was designed to work?
Well, I'd say a couple things. Yeah, I agree. The immediate crisis certainly hasn't passed. You know, public safety is always our top priority, and this is not over. There are still active flood fights going on east of Kansas City as people are trying to prevent levees from being overtopped. And there's a long-term recovery period also that's going to come. And I would tell you that we're in this for the long haul with our state and local partners. Our role in these next steps is to working with state, local partners, and federal and non-federal levy sponsors to assess and then help repair those levees in order to make sure that they can serve their purpose for the next high water event.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to one other comment I'd make. You know, I think it's important to just mention that levee districts have done a tremendous job, you know, both in fighting the floods, but I think of all of within the Kansas City district area responsibility, which is really all I can comment on, is all the levees that have had water go over them were overtopped. Some have breached since they've been overtopped, but none breached before the overtopping. You know, and in my mind, that's a testament to the levee districts and the maintenance that they are doing on those systems for the non-federal, both the non-federal and the federal systems, and also to the program that we have in place that they did all function as designed.
We're going to have to leave it there. So much more we could talk about. Colonel Douglas Guttormson, the Kansas City District Commander for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We've also had Bill Brinton, the Emergency Management Coordinator for Buchanan County, with us. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to my colleague, KCUR's Peggy Lowe. The forecast says that there's potentially more flooding a couple of weeks away.
That's absolutely right. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you. When we come back, we will talk about race and the history of executions in Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. It's a surprising story from the 50s and 60s, and it may speak to the current conversation about the death penalty and military justice today. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. Welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. On Friday on the program, Congresswoman Charisse Davids is about 3 months into her first term as a U.S. representative. We spoke with her about her time in Washington so far. You can hear that at kcur.org/up to date. Join us tomorrow. Our political panel will catch us up on the Kansas City mayor's race, legislative sessions on both sides of the state line, and how lawmakers in the area are reacting to the flooding we talked about today. That's tomorrow on the program. Today, in the last half of the 1950s, there were 8 white soldiers on the Army's death row at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. 8 white soldiers, one by one, each of them with the help of experienced attorneys, intervening officers, even a nationwide letter-writing campaign, each one was spared. In fact, most were paroled and eventually released. During that same period, the Army hanged 8 other soldiers. Their crimes, no more or less shocking than their counterparts, but there were no public outpourings of support, no presidential interventions. Over and over, the black soldiers were led to the gallows. Their stories are told in a new book by Richard Serrano called Summoned at Midnight, A Story of Race and the Last Military Executions at Fort Leavenworth. And Richard Serrano joins us today to shed some light on those stories from the studios of WETA in Arlington, Virginia. Richard, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, Brian.
It's great to have you here. So,
thank you.
You've reported on a lot of things, the Defense Department, over decades as a journalist. How did you come across this story? Why hadn't the stories of these men's lives come out before?
Well, I first learned about it about 40 years ago when I was a very young reporter at the Star, Kansas City, and an older reporter by the name of Jim Fisher, who was a mentor of mine, had mentioned once to me that he had witnessed an execution, and he said, if you're going to make a career in newspapers, you have to, at some point, witness an execution. And I was just amazed by that, and I kept it in my head for about 10 years, and by the mid-80s, I was on the city desk, the paper, and at night, I would go out and drive out to Fort Leavenworth, and by now, the people who had worked there in the 50s were retired, and each night, two or three nights a week, I'd interview a former guard or a Army lawyer or a chaplain or a psychologist, a commandant, and they would tell me the stories of these men that were on death row, and half white, half of them white and half of them black. And I really didn't know what I was going to do with this, but I would interview them and come back the next day at work, type up my notes, and another day or two go back out. And actually, I found four of the fellows who got off and interviewed them as well, and found the hangman in Topeka, and spent a couple of days with him. And I still didn't really know what I was going to do with that. And eventually, I left the Star and went to the Los Angeles Times. And driving out to California, I did three more interviews, one in Waco with another chaplain and a couple of soldiers in New Mexico. But it was always in the back of my head, and I started sending FOIAs and getting Army records. And
Freedom of Information Act requests, yeah.
Yes, yes, and getting all kinds of material about various cases. And it was only really until I retired from newspapers. I spent most of my life and career in here in Washington, D.C., in the L.A. Times, Washington Bureau, and covering the Justice Department and the war on terror and so forth. But anyway, once I retired, I decided to go back and look at those cases, and I went up to the Library of Congress, and they had all the transcripts, and they had the appellate files on all 16 of the cases. But they did not specify which ones were white or black. And I just assumed, unfortunately, that most of them were probably black, particularly for that time period in the 50s. These were soldiers who were all convicted of homicide, and they were on death row in Fort Leavenworth. Leavenworth then was the, and still is, the main Army prison, and there's a death row there now. But anyway, I came out to Kansas City and drove out to the Eisenhower Library and went again through his files. And all of the cases that were of the white soldiers, and then they specified in there whether they're white or black, were very, very thick. And they were filled with letters from politicians. And
yeah. And the files of the black soldiers, of course, not as thick. Are you still there, Richard? Richard, can you hear me? Sounds like Richard may not be able to hear us at this point. I can hear Richard breathing, but I don't think he is.
No, I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Richard, okay, Richard is here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. We had a little interference there.
I apologize.
Anyway, that's no problem. In the Eisenhower Library, I started going through these files, and the eight files for the white soldiers were very thick. A lot of support, community support, political support, and letter writing campaigns. The media, the press got behind these guys.
But the files for the black soldiers
were paper thin.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about that that history. We're talking about the years from 1955 to 1961. I guess it's coincidence that there were the same number of white and black soldiers on death row, almost exactly. What kind of crimes were these soldiers in for? They were almost all homicide cases, with the exception of one of the black inmates, right?
Correct. They were all homicide except for one. Actually, he was a 17th soldier, and he was a black a private from Southern Virginia who had raped a white girl. And in the Army at that time, that was a capital offense. And his trial lasted one day. He went on trial with it a week of the offense, and his trial lasted half a day, and an all-white jury sentenced him to death.
And I want to talk about that inmate, Private John Bennett, because his story really begins and ends your book, and is woven throughout it. But let's talk a little bit about how these white inmates were able to be excused from execution. Who was rising to their support? Why was that happening?
Almost all of the white soldiers were from the North, and they weren't particularly wealthy at all. But they had their local politicians, their local representatives and senators would write letters to the Eisenhower White House, begging for mercy. They would get support from letter writing campaigns. Eventually, either the Army courts or the federal courts, or Eisenhower himself, granted clemency. And that didn't mean they immediately got off. They then had to go back into the mainstream of the prison. But within a couple of years, or 10 years at the most, they were paroled and went home to their families.
Meanwhile, the African American soldiers, that is not how it worked out. How many of those soldiers were executed?
There were 10 of them, and 8 were executed.
And their crimes, were they more heinous than their white counterparts? Were they different in some way?
They were not more heinous. In fact, the white soldiers had committed much worse crimes. Some of them had killed children and multiple murderers and just much more awful offenses.
So what was going on there? Why was the military justice system different? I think a lot of times, obviously this was a very racially divided time in America. I think a lot of times the military is held up as somehow being on the forefront of black soldiers and white soldiers serving in very similar ways. That didn't seem to be the case for the military justice system.
Well, I think that's true about the Army and all the armed forces today. It was not true at all back then. When President Truman desegregated the Army, the rank and file and the officer corps really resisted that. All through much of the Korean War, there was a lot of hatred among women, particularly white soldiers from the South, who made up a big, large percentage of enlistees in the service. And so there was a lot of distrust and dislike between the two races, and even the blacks were still relegated to driving trucks or, you know, building bridges, whereas the whites got more of the lead jobs. So that system was ingrained into the service by then. And even at Fort Leavenworth, I mean, all the guards were white, and all the commanding corps was all white, and it was just the Army was not a black man's army.
The individual soldier that you spend the most time writing about in this book is Private First Class John Bennett. He's the one who was accused and convicted of raping a girl in Austria in 1954. He's the only one of those that you write about who was actually not convicted of homicide. His story seems to be illustrative of the situation that African American soldiers faced as they were brought up on capital offenses. Tell us about John Bennett.
John Bennett was a young man from Southern Virginia. His two older brothers had gone into service and served well. One became a master sergeant, and so he followed them into the Army. And he ended up in Austria in 1954, 1955, and he had all kinds of mental problems. He had had history of epilepsy. He had dizzying spells. He would black out, and his he was coming back. He was on leave. He was off duty. He was coming back from a bar in off base, and he came across a white girl in the just off side of a woods, and he raped her. There's no doubt that he raped her, and that in itself was terrible. But he was arrested before the sun went down, and he was tried within a week or two, and he was sentenced to death.
And I was struck by the reaction of the community in Austria to his death sentence.
Correct. In Austria then, there was no death sentence. They did not allow capital punishment. And rape, the maximum for rape was 20 years. And they insisted that the U.S. Army turn them over to Austrian justice. In addition, the crime itself was not committed on the Army base. It was committed on Austrian soil. And the ambassador and some others and the community really rose up and demanded that Bennett be given Austrian justice. But this was during the U.S. occupation. It was still not quite 10 years after World War II, and the U.S. Army was still occupying that part of the world, and they simply refused.
Why?
Well, I think part of it was because they wanted to show that Army justice would be swift and harsh, and they were not like the Gestapo or the Nazis that everybody, even as late as 54 and 55, remembered, and that they could handle this case.
They put him on trial. The jury took 25 minutes to convict him to sentence him to death. What happened after that?
They sent him to Hamburg, Germany, and they put him on a boat, sailed him to the East Coast, and sent him to Fort Leavenworth. And Fort Leavenworth, the death row then was in sort of a semi-basement called Seven Base. And it was... He just joined the rest of the so-called gang there, and his cell was at the end of the tier, and he was the youngest of them, and all of them, black and white, thought that he would, of all of them, he would get out, and particularly as his case went through the courts, and by the end of 1960, he's the last one on death row. All the others have either been hung, or they've been commuted and gone home, so he's the last one. And his case then rolls into the Kennedy administration in the early months of 1961. And by then, Bennett had they had no money. They were sharecroppers in Southern Virginia and tobacco farming. And so they were able to get the help from a young black civil rights attorney in Danville, Virginia, who'd never done a capital case and really was wading in waters he was unfamiliar with. But he tried his best.
And that's in contrast to the white soldiers who all were represented by experienced military attorneys.
Totally in contrast. Totally different. But his attorney put together a clemency plea to Kennedy saying that he had mental issues, that it's possible he could have been under some kind of... some kind of failure when this happened, and brought up again the whole Austrian argument. They should have been tried by the Austrians, and they really thought they had a shot with the new president. He was young and a Democrat and a Catholic, a liberal, and they really thought they had a shot. And there was a lot of argument within that new Kennedy administration as to what to do with this case. I mean, Kennedy didn't want it. It was an Eisenhower holdover, but he was faced with it.
And you mentioned the transition in presidential administrations. Obviously, that would have caused a lot of people to expect that there might be a better chance of clemency being extended to Bennett, right? With the Kennedy administration and a different outlook and evolving sense of what capital punishment should be like in America.
You would think so, but instead it was the opposite happened. They decided some in Kennedy Council's office decided if they could find the girl and her family and if they could in Austria, and if they could if they came back recommending mercy, maybe that would bear heavily for Kennedy, and they did. They found the girl and her parents, and they recited the same arguments that there was no death penalty there, and despite what happened was horrible, that another death doesn't resolve anything. And they presented that to Kennedy, too, and then Kennedy made the decision.
You also wrote at length in the book about Master Sergeant William H. Maddox, who became the official executioner during this period at Leavenworth. And you actually ended up getting to talk with him. How did he end up in that role?
You know, I liked him a lot. I found him. He lived in a small little house in Topeka, and he had a couple of boxes, cardboard boxes, in a closet. And the second time I went to see him, he pulled them out, and these were all his records from being a hangman. And he supervised or participated in over 100 of these executions, beginning he was a career Army soldier, but beginning in Tokyo when they were hanging the Japanese war criminals, And then he ended up getting transferred back to Kansas, to Fort Riley, and the U.S. Army began to speed up their executions at Fort Leavenworth, so they asked him to do those. He was a delightful guy. I mean, he was tall in skin and very, very pale white fellow, but he was always afraid that someday somebody would find him, a son of some, you know, a relative or somebody, and get him. So he was a man of disguises. He would gain weight and lose weight. He'd grow whiskers and lose whiskers, and he'd wear hats, and he was always nervous about that. But he really knew his craft, and he was not at all ashamed of it, and in some ways kind of proud of what he did. But
all of this story unfolds in the town of Leavenworth, within our listening area, not far from Kansas City. I have to wonder how this going on inside the fort, inside the depths of this military prison, whether that had any connection to what was happening out in the town of Leavenworth in the late 1950s.
Well, not so much in the late 1950s. Earlier, there had been some racial incidents in Leavenworth, just as there were anywhere else in the country, and Kansas City as well, but some attacks against the black soldiers there. But it wasn't so much then. But what is interesting is that the prison then was what they used to call the castle, because it looked like this big stone and cement castle and limestone that they built off the Missouri River. But they had it was a very historic building. It had been there almost 100 years, but it had outgrown its use, and they tore it down some years back and built a new one. And where the old castle is now is just a parking lot. But they have four guys on death row today. Of the four, three are men of color.
So there's still this is still an issue, which brings me to kind of this, the couple of minutes we have left here. This obviously was a limited period of time and a very small sample size, if you will, in terms of the number of prisoners involved. And yet, do you think this story has something to tell us about the state of criminal justice in America?
Well, I think that I've during my career as a covering Justice Department and law and order, there you go to any prison and it's stacked with many young black men, and I'm not excusing them at all, but that's just the way it is and the way the system is, and when you go into the system, if you have the means and the savvy to hire the right people and get yourself out of these predicaments, good. But most of them don't. And so that's the way. And then with the three strikes laws and some of those, they really stacked the deck against a lot of these guys, and spending horrible time in long periods in prison. But it's just the way it is. And until Washington begins to reform, there's been some changes. Obama made some changes, and Trump just did as well. But until they get serious about criminal prison reform, that's going to stay the same, probably.
And the death penalty debate, too, has sort of come back to life with a lot of places, a lot of states, even not terribly liberal states, taking a hard look at whether the system is too inherently unjust to keep functioning this way.
Well, the capital punishment is so expensive. It is not expensive because of what they do. I mean, it doesn't cost any money to put a needle in a man's arm and execute them. What the expense is, it just takes years and years and years, and there's a tremendous amount of money that goes into legal fees and legal costs. And if you take a guy who, say, he's 20 and give him life sentence versus somebody who's 20 and give him a death sentence, the death sentence guy could live 20 or 30 years, could live as long as the guy who got life, but it's going to be triple and quadruple the amount of cost.
Well, a lot of really interesting questions raised by this story of a period in history not far from here in Kansas City. Richard Serrano, author of Summoned at Midnight, A Story of Race and the Last Military Executions at Fort Leavenworth. Richard, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us.
Thank you, Brian.
You can hear previous episodes of this program at kcur.org/up-to-date, including Friday's review of the films showing in local theaters. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. I'm at PTS Brian. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, the importance of right-sizing religious liberty and why one minister hopes it will help his children and grandchildren enjoy religious liberty and the separation of church and state. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.